Hello, this is Cameron and Bob again, and we're starting session number 41.
And it might be 42.
No, I checked with it. We did 40.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, the last
okay.
one. November 4th was 40. And so we're looking at my pamphlet again, my broadside, and we're on page 77 at the top. And we've sort of mentioned this shortly at the end of the last session. And so I'm going to read something here that will spark Cameron to say something. Meanwhile, the abrasive confrontational aspects of tactility surfed over the old discard-merge-slash-interrupting surfaces. This evoked the dominance of the neoconservative liberal meme-slash-preference in the global membrane of the last 35 years. So that goes in 1985? Yeah, it'd be 40 from 80 to now. So yeah, in 1985. So just after the archetypal 1984 year. This evoked the dominance of the neoconservative liberal meme preference in the global membrane of the last 35 years. Not knowing this aspect of McLuhan's tactility led to a discounting of McLuhan's relevance on a, quote, theoretical level for educational purposes.
Yeah. So let's just stop there. There's a few questions.
Okay.
I got.
Okay.
First off, you talk about the global membrane, the global membrane,
yes.
Singular. So you conceive the global membrane as a singular at all times so that the history of the world is one global membrane after another, or are there multiple global membranes at any one time, but one that is sort of the majority voice?
First of all, we might have mentioned that this phrase is used in McLuhan's review of Burroughs in December 1964 in Nation magazine.
Correct.
Then
yes,
you
sir.
Found a couple of more locations of it a week or
yeah,
two later.
Yeah, I found five or six total, and I have a post just called Membrane that gives the context of all of them.
So I could bring that up?
Sure.
So I go to McLuhan Sciences.
Yeah.
And then look in your index.
Yeah, just look off to the right-hand side because it's one of the latest
right.
ones.
Right.
And you'll get it.
Okay. Membrane. Okay, you've got 1962 in the Gutenberg Galaxy. McLuhan says, people of literary and critical bias find the shrill vehemence of Desjardins, that's Teilhard de Chardin, as disconcerting as his uncritical enthusiasm for the cosmic membrane. Wow. That has been snapped round the globe by the electric dilation of our various senses. Dilation means expansion, right?
Correct. Yes, sir.
Bigger. Then he's got an article, Electronic Age, - the Age of Implosion, 1962. He says, electricity has wrapped the planet in a single cohesive field or membrane that is organic rather than mechanical in nature. Now, you have all this stuff in one big document, and you can search it real fast?
Pretty much.
Okay, that's pretty good. Then in the notes on Burroughs, 1964, he says, such is the law of electric media which stretched the nerves to form a global membrane of enclosure. 72, in Take Today, page 217, government had begun in a modest way as the figure of the helmsman. The ship represents the entire human community. Today the rudder has become much larger than the ship.
What a great line. Right?
Yes, that is. I certainly forgot that one. The number of helmsmen are coextensive with the community. That means everybody is a helmsman, right, to handle the huge rudder.
That's right. That relates to hijacking.
Yeah, that's pretty good. The hijacker is the rudder. you like
well,
that?
Takes over the rudder.
Okay, do the people hijack the rudder? Isn't the rudder hijacked the people?
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
I think both happen.
Yep.
The possibility of the hijacker means that the rudder has changed, has been transformed.
Yeah. You know, a good definition of tactility is both and is italicized.
Yes.
You know?
That's right. But yeah. When we get back to your book, I'll have something to say about that, because when you talk about the abrasive potential of tactility, that introduces a kind of knot, K-N-O-T, into the both and of tactility. Because in order for tactility to be both and, it must include either or. Because if it didn't include either or, then it wouldn't be both and.
Right.
So that's the big difficulty of tactility, is that it's a very knotted, K-N-O-T-T, concept.
Yeah, it doesn't, it's the big now. It doesn't get cut off. It
Correct.
Includes everything.
Correct.
Right. So I was thinking last night, mentioned on this show I was on, people in the 60s started to talk about going with the flow. And McLuhan talked about the flow of electric life. So people thought that was an optimistic thing. So they didn't know there's the discontinuity or the abrupt interface. So I then said, it just occurred to me that the flow was the archetypalizing of the smooth surfaces of the automobile hood, and maybe the movie, and maybe the radio, but not so much. But he talked about the smooth surfaces, which created the, which was echoed by swing jazz, big band jazz. Then rock brought in the, rock and roll brought in the discontinuous abrupt interfaces, including the body language, you know, of Elvis. So the flow was really retrieving the smooth surfaces he once defined as the hot era before television, the media of that period, mainly the automobile. The smooth surfaces is what people were saying, go with the flow. They had become conscious of the ground of smooth surfaces of the auto era, and that's what they meant. And then as the 60s and 70s and 80s unfolded, people started to bump into stuff, factors that they hadn't foreseen of tactility. The abrupt interfaces took over, and people lost the flow. And I saw this in Carolyn's practice. People really started to get stressed out with environmental allergies and chronic fatigue and all that. The bumping, As the smooth flow receded, because we were moving into maybe the Android meme spaces, so the abrupt interfaces of tactility became figure. And basically life became ruder, not so decent. The general impression that life has gotten, the people have gotten more crass. Okay. Anyway, that was a pattern I never thought of before. Going with the flow is actually refers to the smooth surfaces of the hot, electric hot period in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, you might be able to make that concrete by looking at razor blade ads. You know, the World Series and boxing matches and stuff always used to be brought by Gillette.
Oh, yeah.
And what Gillette could do for you was produce a smooth surface on your skin.
Right.
And then going forward a couple decades, that kind of advertising got lost. And the beard started to come in.
Yeah.
And notice was taken that the old razor blades didn't shave black people very well, right? That it was producing cuts and bumps on their skin, right? And so you would have this what you're talking about here with go with the flow from that, you know, the nice shaving cream on your face and get your nice face and all of this got lost over a couple decades there.
So I assume what I just said you hadn't heard before, but as soon as I said it, the Gillette ad came to your mind, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Complimentary fill-in, sensory fill-in there, right?
Yeah.
My shocking environment of the rearview mirror archetype forced your senses to organize, retrieve a complimentary image. That's very good. So, remember McLuhan said that the baby boomers were nostalgic for their grandfathers, and that's why they put on farmer's overalls and wore beards. You know, they were trying to get back to a chemical body ground in a way to get back to Earth as created by the printing press.
Yeah, and he was always thinking about Michael.
Oh, yeah, right.
He was
a great barometer of world changes.
Correct.
That's right. He was the kid who had been fully TV seduced, TV massaged. He was not like the older kids. Right?
Yeah, well, I guess. I mean,
No, that's what he said. He said that Michael was very different from the other kids because he had grown up fully with TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember him saying that. But the relationship with the girls is something that needs some teasing out. I don't really know too much about it, but the girls were all different from each other, and their relationship with the old man must have been different from each other.
Yes. Well, Mary always told me that she was Terry's twin, so they were the oldest daughters.
Right.
But they were younger than Eric. And Mary said everybody, probably the girls, all agreed that Mary was Marshall's favorite because she was most like Corinne.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that within the family mythology, I mean, that's what Mary said.
Yeah,
you know, but
I've got a sign of that from when they were babies. The godfather of Eric was Bernie Muller-Thieme.
Yeah,
and then when the girls had to be baptized, they were trying to figure out who would be the godfather of Mary and who would be the godfather of Terry. And Mary got Bernie Muller-Thieme again.
Mm.
And that was Muller-Thieme was kind of McLuhan's hero and model at the time.
Right. So Mary got a little bit of help.
That's correct.
Favored. Yeah.
Right from the start.
Right. Well, and what did Terry get? Who?
You know, I don't know, but I think it was one of the people in Windsor.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of the people there, but I know there was a guy that was a priest there, and then his sister helped the McLuhan family all the time.
That was Paulette or Pauline, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, good man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think she's talked in one of the CD-ROMs she talks, right?
I don't know.
I think she does.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that first CD-ROM that came out, you know, in 96 or so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, let's see. Okay, so what else did Mary say? She used to say that Marshall would fake up some talk down in L.A. or she was down in what's it called? LaGuardia. What do you call the
Laguna?
Laguna, yeah. I think she was down there at one point when she was still married, and Marshall liked to hang out with Mary. And so he would say, oh, I got to go speak, you know, I got to speak to the mayor there in L.A. Now, maybe he did do that, but Mary said he would come, he would use excuses to get to see Mary, maybe make up stuff.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, and he liked hanging out with Mary, and he liked the granddaughter Emily, I think. No, I don't know. No, Emily's one of Eric's daughters. I forget her name. So so Mary had a lot of interesting stories. Well, she was honest, kind of bragging, but to me, she was just honest about what she really thought was going on. And she also got to live with the Gossages, you know? So she she gets out there, and she was going to the University of Windsor, I think, and then I don't know if she'd finished, but she went out to Banff for summer work, and then she decided not to go back to school, but maybe she had finished. And so she just, on her own, went down to San Francisco without telling anybody, and when she got there, she realized, well, I might need some support, some financial support, so she called the family and told Marshall and Corinne that she was now in San Francisco, and I don't know what kind of you know, questions or advice she asked for, but they said, go look up Howard Gossage. So she did, and she ended up, I think, staying with them for a couple of years. And it was in that period, one day she was walking to work, and it would have been Newsweek, and I think that was in spring, February, March, 66. He's on the cover. And remember, he didn't get on Time's cover, but he got on Newsweek. And she's walking along, and then there she sees in the magazine stand a picture of her father. Now she says, I had no understanding why that he would be there. Like, she was totally clueless about what he was doing as a professor. And and I don't think there, it wasn't on the cover, but maybe in the article, there was this big question, what if he's right? And she said it was absolutely stunning, funny, shocking, that everybody was wondering whether what if her father was right. It totally personalized the thing, you know what I mean? Like a little mind, a little girl's mind. What? They're all worried about my father and whether he's right. So it was quite funny the way she described the effect. So it also showed the dream world she was in a sense. She was in living her, what do you call it, becoming an adult, working in the world, being on her own. Now, she got married.
Yeah, coming of age.
Yeah, and she got married December 66, so she was married just after that. So that would be the period when we assume she met this guy, you know, within earlier parts of 66. I don't know how quickly they got married. But it would have mean that she was going to work on her own and, you know, single person, and she saw her father there. So that was shocking. So she had a lot of stories about the Gossages, which right now I can't remember any, none of them come to mind. But it became a tragedy because he died in 69, and his son committed suicide in there at some point. So I remember Edgar Z. Friedenberg, who did The Vanishing Adolescent and is quoted in Gutenberg Gauss. He taught at Dalhousie in Halifax, so I used to sit in his class. And he talked about, he thought there was something ominous there, that the guy who promoted McLuhan ended up having his son kill himself. Right. So Friedenberg was a bit suspicious of that. But he didn't really like McLuhan. I think I told you that he went to a conference at some point, and Morris was there, and Morris was subbing in for Marshall, and Morris announced that Marshall was an only child. And Friedenberg, who had grown up in the South, he was kind of like a Truman Capote character, you know, a small bookworm kind of kid, and very smart and sensitive and gay. And so he had a bit of an outsider reality, and so he was very sensitive to Marshall saying he was an only child, or the brother saying that. He thought that was shocking. And I remember him, he didn't like James Joyce. James Joyce was too cold, he said. It's interesting. I mean, most intellectuals would say they liked Joyce or Ulysses, you know what I mean? They did. They tended, probably they had to say they liked it, but he just said, no, I don't like Joyce, he's cold. So he was an interesting contrast for me in relation to processing McLuhan and Friedenberg at the same time. That was a four-year period, 73 to 77, just before we came to Toronto. And so found it interesting how he performed. He had been pretty successful as a public intellectual, wrote articles for the New York Review books and things like that. And then he got really pissed off about Vietnam, so he couldn't, as a conscience, as American, he couldn't have a clear conscience of staying in the United States. So he purposely moved to Canada so he would not be implicated in the Vietnam crisis. So he isolated himself at Dalhousie. So he would just sit there and talk. And these were graduate in education, the Department of Education. They were graduates, I think, not undergraduates. And he would just talk, well, in a way like Marshall did in Monday night, and maybe in his classes. And the kids didn't know what the hell he was talking about. They didn't know enough, and it was quite worldly and sophisticated and stuff. And so then there was a great mail strike, postal strike in 75, and like for 4 months or something, we got no mail. And he was in total agony because he couldn't get his New Yorker and all the magazines he subscribed to. He was addicted to them. And he felt like totally at loss, you know. He was falling behind. And he would talk about this in the class. So that's one of the things I remember about him. Okay, so we're talking about Mary and the twins. Why did that come up?
Oh, we went from... Michael over to the girl.
Oh, what he said about Michael. Yeah, he... So in the documentary Telescope that CBC did, Michael is the odd man out. He's a TV child. In a way, he's going to be an independent kid. So he says he doesn't believe his father. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
I may have brought this up, you know, 39 shows ago, but just they might start. I tell people to start listening right at the latest, you know, the ones
sure,
we're doing.
Why not?
Yeah, so they wouldn't have heard this. He says in the documentary, he discounts his father. Why? Well, I came home from school one day and Dad asked me, what'd you learn today? And he said, I learned that Brasilia was the capital of Brazil. And his father said, no, he said, Dad said, no, he didn't. No, it isn't. Rio de Janeiro. Is it Rio de Janeiro? I think it is. Is the capital. And the kid said, no, no, the teacher taught us in Brasilia. Well, your teacher's wrong. And this is said in the documentary. That is his contribution to the documentary. And he said, I never listened to Dad after that.
Yeah.
And then he got into, getting into a bit of the dope world and got in trouble. But he represented the kid who was not was outside of the nuclear family, right? He'd been molested by the cool TV image and the global membrane. So that
he had gone out of the micro family into the macro family.
Yeah, he went and left the micro. okay, so back to this. So in 73, in the implications of cultural uniformity, 1973, which is a good article, I know that article, Phineas Wake is very much concerned with the resonance in the tribal membrane in quotes, and the drama among the instincts and the artifacts of language and technology, leading to the awareness of the electric role in waking or retrieving the old tribal man. Then you have in Superculture, that's a good article too. Superculture, why is that? It's after 73, I see. So you have a footnote. Superculture.
Yeah, so the article, Implications of Cultural Uniformity, is in
that
Superculture.
Book. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you explain. With tribal membrane, McLuhan was citing from William Empson's great poem, Arachne, quote, King spider walks the velvet roof of streams. Must bird and fish, must god and beast avoid. Dance like nine angels on pinpoint extremes. His gleaming bubble between void and void, tribe hyphenated, tribe membrane that by mutual tension stands, Earth's surface film is at a breath destroyed. Ooh, that's he's describing what I was talking about. The hot
that's
surface
right.
is tactility, the tribal membrane upsets that. Well, that's very interesting. So basically, it confirms how I imagine the global membrane. It is a resonant node. It's a spot that we're all in, which has no dimensions. So if you ask people to consider what is tactility, if McLuhan says it's not a sense, it's the interplay of senses. It's not a sense. People might say, okay, or I'll tell them, think of it as your mind. The mind is the thing that we can't find. It's very hard to say what the mind is. And they talk about, you know, the difference between the brain and the mind. So the ineffableness of the mind is like tactility, which is not a sense. So the global membrane is an extension of mind or tactility. And we've imploded in this one spot. Like we could right now, somebody could, you know, conference in with us and then get some, you know, NORAD computer and then hook up a billion people, right? And they all be in the conference call. We'd all be in this one ineffable space, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and it would be the space that people would think their mind is, but it's been externalized. So it's one global membrane is what I would say when you ask me. It's not more than one. Now, the digital, so that happens with television. The digital breaks that up. You can disconnect from the global membrane. At least half of you can. See, so I see that the digital, which is the Android meme, brings in more and more autonomy. You get me?
Well, I think autonomy would need to be teased apart there. Autonomy can cover too many things to work as a definition there.
Well, it's the environment gives you the autonomy, so it's not pure autonomy. But the digital environment allows you to disconnect from the global membrane and go off into another space.
That's right. But there is one sort of autonomy that belongs to every different kind of space. So the autonomy that you get that you're talking about here disconnection relates to what we were saying earlier about how the flow changed.
Yeah.
There was an autonomy that was associated with the smooth membrane. But there's also an autonomy that goes with the abrasive membrane.
Yes.
And sort of the trick in all of this is to understand how these characteristics hang together, right? And that hanging together is what you could call the total range of tactility.
Yeah. So the telephone, McLuhan said, that allows you to bypass the organization chart and call the boss or interact with the boss directly or set up your own networks. Before electrics, you were in a print newspaper bureaucracy, and how could you conspire in that? You just basically assassinate the boss or something. But you couldn't you don't have a medium to create a network within the bureaucracy. It's all written messages or not written, but you're dealing with a written thing. So the first phase of autonomy is the effect of the telephone from the prison of the literate bureaucracy. Then the digital, that puts you, it's like I could disconnect from talking to you and go and talk to someone else. you would know that I did that. Or if I had some sophisticated technology, I could do it on another. I could be texting on my cell phone, on another phone, and you wouldn't know about that. So the autonomy of the digital is more comprehensive than the autonomy that the phone starts to create. So the phone is analog, and then the digital spaces, they're more subtle. I don't know. You get more micro, more layers of micro with this texting world.
Yeah. So it's not that the layers of the micro weren't there before, right? And if you imagine a IBM in 1935 or something like this, everybody's dressed the same and everybody has their place in the corporate order and all this sort of stuff. But if you drill down, all of the people are different. All of their families are different. Everybody has different problems. Everybody has different bodies, et cetera. But it's not explicit. And so with change of technological environment, things become explicit that previously were implicit.
Yeah. In other words, you can see on Instagram.
Correct.
And remember Marshall said in the Take Today in 72, the video phone would not be accepted at that point because people would be too hassled with if they had to answer their video phone and be visible on the screen, they'd have to tidy themselves up or something. So people, mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. couldn't handle being seen. The literate or the baby boomer, the older than the baby boomers, had a stronger sense of private, a separation between private slovenliness and going out in public. You've seen social life in the street for the last 30 years has become way more slovenly. People
Correct.
Wearing sneakers and sweatshirts, you know. I remember my mother being appalled that people wore sneakers. It was being in the 70s, outside of the gymnasium. You know what I mean? That was shocking. But they had a very high preference for visual order. So the video phone couldn't work in 72, but it could work in 2002. You know, people are allowing. When did people start seeing themselves on their phones?
I don't know, but I've got a good example of what you're talking about from Ian and Bob.
Oh, okay.
There was Ed put up a segment from the Megyn Kelly show.
Yeah.
It's an interview with Kash Patel.
Oh, yeah.
And Megyn is all made up. And you can tell that she's trying to follow a script and stuff. And she's terrible at what she's trying to do.
Yeah.
If you compare it to Amazing Polly, for example.
Yeah.
Amazing Polly is just fantastic at doing what she does.
Yeah. Did you see her latest one called Raw, where she was quite disheveled in her emotions? And she came on early in the morning smoking, her hair a mess, and in her bathrobe and drinking. Did you see that one? And she had it with her mother.
No,
oh, it's
no.
great. She declares war on her mother.
She's been smoking a lot in lately. So
yeah, she had that. She never smoked. I started watching her a year ago. Never smoked, yeah, but she did once a little the other day, but she just sat there smoking. It was exactly like, you know, when you're in suburbia and you visit your neighbor. and you're friendly, so she's going to sit there in her morning bathrobe, you know, and drink her coffee.
That's
and
right.
Complain. That's what she was doing. Yeah,
exactly.
But she pulls it off. She's
yeah.
very, I really like her face. Her face is very, I don't know, real.
Yeah, she comes across as a real person talking about real stuff.
Right.
And if you compare it to Megyn Kelly, the stuff that she's talking about is important, but it's all canned.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all what she's doing is the same thing that she used to do on Fox, and then I think she worked for MSNBC. Or,
yeah.
I'm not sure some other group gave her millions and millions of dollars, and it didn't work out. So now in her retirement or whatever, she's become an interviewer with her own show.
Yeah.
But just look it up. I mean, it's she's just terrible at it because she doesn't understand how the sorts of stuff that you're talking about now works.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think I just glanced at that shot of the screen. Wasn't Patel really slovenly dressed?
Yeah.
I noticed
absolutely.
That. Yeah, I said, see that guy.
Yeah. and so he comes across as the way he should.
Yeah.
He comes across like the amazing Paulie does.
Yeah.
And so it's like somebody from 1965 interviewing somebody from 2021.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a joke.
And, okay, so the thing about Paulie, I think her face is a tribal mask. You know what I mean? Everything's perfectly proportioned. And so you don't get her personality, her uniqueness in her face. Her face is always the same. It has a good repertoire of facial expressions, you know. It comes across very rubbery and natural. But you really think of it. Remember how McLuhan would say that the chiaroscuro of the white person's face on color TV really looked pale and didn't work.
Yeah.
And the smooth, whatever you call it, of the black face was way more iconic and mask-like for color TV. And she, as a white person, has that quality in her face, the black quality, I think. Anyways, that's what I've looked at her for a lot now, you know, for almost a year. And
Do you watch only on Ian and Bob, or do you watch on her own channel?
No, I do it on Ian and Bob, and so I'm missing all the other videos she's making. I don't go to anywhere else.
I
only have time for one a week, so to speak, that she's been doing. Why, do you go to the other places?
No, I only do Ian and Bob.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen her for a while because Ed hasn't put any up for a while.
Well, you might have missed it. Go back a few, you know, page 6 or 7. Maybe I'll find it and send it to you. And it's called Raw, and that's the one where, you see, she made a documentary. Did you see that? You probably didn't see
that.
Yeah,
I did. The one where she's talking about the restaurant in Kingston.
Yeah,
I saw it.
Okay. It got the lowest views.
Yeah. I saw her talking about that.
Oh, okay. Then you saw the one where she was smoking. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, but I thought that she sort of screwed up on the documentary because she tried to make it like the sort of documentary that anybody would make.
Yeah.
Right. So the amazing Paulie, when she just comes on and talks and smokes and has her cup of coffee and stuff like that, that's only the amazing Paulie. But the documentary was generic.
So that's right.
I didn't think it was all that great.
Well, I didn't know that was her narrating for like 10 or 15 minutes into it.
Right.
You know, it wasn't her voice.
That's right. Her voice was off.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, the drama was that her mother and daughter refused to watch it. and her mother said, that's just a lot of negative stuff. And they're living in the community there. It's your neighbor down the street that's getting in trouble, you know, being shut down. So Paulie's appalled at her mother saying, you know, I ain't engaging in your negative stuff. And then the mother calls her back like an hour later and goes on and on about the disaster in British Columbia with all the flooding, the most negative stuff going. And she says to her mother, look, you're talking about real negative stuff out there. My video has a positive outcome. It's positive. She wouldn't have it. Then the mother, like, just before she hangs up, she says, just start having a good time. I don't know what her name is. I don't think Polly's a real name.
The mother thinks that Polly's falling apart.
Yeah.
And she may be right.
Yes. Okay. So anyways, Polly was criticized for not being able to have a good time anymore. You know, be happy. And so that was, what do you call it? That's war talk. Those are fighting words. So Polly says, that's a problem. You got a lot of people out there who just want to be happy. And they're not looking at what's sneaking up on them, the disaster that's coming. And so she says, I want you out there, the people I love, the ones who had looked at the documentary, you know, my people understand me. We have to declare war on my mother. That's what she said. We can't have my mother win. That type of person is going to ruin us if we all just look for happy days. So she says early in the video that she said, I'm even having problems with my family. But by the end of the video, if you didn't watch it all, she goes into the details of it. So then Carolyn saw this, and she said later, "What isn't she like prevented? Her mother won't let her see her daughter?" And I said, yeah, that sounds like, I think she did mention that. Yeah, I think she's blocked from her daughter. Anyways, and then she also had a very bad week. Did you hear the part where her husband got laid off a couple days before this video?
No.
Yeah.
I probably got tired of it.
Yeah.
I didn't watch
you couldn't tell you. It was too personal. It was just draining you. Too involving.
Well, it was too much of the same thing over and over again.
Right.
She couldn't let it go.
Right. You mean within the video?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the... So her husband lost his job, and they said they were prepared for that because they knew he wouldn't tell them whether he'd been vaccinated or not. That was the condition at his particular workplace. So he got fired, and they're dealing with it. And meanwhile, her mail is not coming in like it should, and she needs the mail because that's the checks. She makes a living from this. So
that's
she
right.
thinks somebody in there, the government or somebody, is fucking with her mail. And some other service was getting interrupted. And she talked about back a couple of years ago when she was had huge viewers and was, like, global. And
yeah.
then one
well,
day.
That's when she was on YouTube. And stuff.
Yeah. One day, same day, PayPal and YouTube dropped her. And she said, I lost a lot of money. And I built it back up, but that was a real shocker when they just cut off her livelihood. So she built it back up, and they've been doing well, but now they're in trouble again a little bit. I don't know what they're going to do, but she's in trouble if somebody is stealing her checks. That's a problem. So we're following her career. We're going to see how far this revolution goes. And we interrupt
days of our lives.
Yeah, and we interrupt this dissertation on McLuhan to talk about what McLuhan was talking about—the involvingness of all this stuff. We're involved, right? We're drawn into the soap opera of Polly. we're like at work, standing around the cooler, talking about last night's TV. So we're strictly professional in presenting it this way. Okay. Okay, let's get back to the tech body. Okay, so these quotes, I like that. I had totally forgotten these. Cosmic membrane, cohesive field or membrane, cohesive membrane, global membrane of enclosure, social membrane, tribal membrane, and tribal membrane. So they, to me, seem singular. Maybe even that's the singularity that everybody thinks they understand, the global membrane. You know how people talk about the singularity more and more the last 10 years, as if they know what it is? I would call this implosion a singularity.
Right. But see, if the membrane is singular, then it is so only in chronological time. So it's like one membrane after another, after another, after another. But considering all times, then, of course, the membrane is plural. And in my way of reading McLuhan, which is not chronological but is synchronic, then membrane is naturally plural.
Yeah. Why is there a membrane one after the other?
Well, because when you say that it's singular, it can't be singular for all time, right? It has to be, electricity has wrapped the planet in a single cohesive field. Well, that's a different membrane from the mechanical age, from the Gutenberg galaxy. And that, again, is different from the Paleolithic membrane, right? So membrane singular, if we can talk about it like that, is a moment in time or a period in time, like a Marconi age or the Gutenberg age or Gutenberg era.
Well, I see the global membrane as one space. It has no content, and that's always there. There's only one, and it goes out past the moon.
Okay, so then if he says electricity has wrapped the planet in a single cohesive field, you read that to say that electricity has illuminated the field that was already there but unseen.
Yes. And then another, he talked about stretching the nerves to form a global membrane.
Right. But there, I mean, it would seem, that seems like a chronological image. Right?
No, not to me. When he says snapped around, look, the cosmic membrane has been snapped around the globe. These are instant effect.
Instant, that's right.
Establishment.
But I'm talking about whether or not the instant is the big now or if it's one instant after another. That's the topic that we're on.
Well, I'd say it's beyond now. It's timeless. Uh-huh. It's eternity. Externalized. Because it's we can always tap into it, and we can't touch it. We can only be the content for it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying it. It's sort of an Asian topic from Hinduism or Buddhism or something, right? That's what you seem to be saying.
Right. Here's an interesting point. I met these people in the 60s out in Seattle, and Dave Wurster channeled what was called cosmic awareness. And in the mythology of what they said, there was a unified membrane. They didn't use those words. But then there'd be ripples of experience in consciousness, and consciousness was in this, you know, plane of essence, a place of relative serenity or something. And we may not have been animals yet or human bodies. So he would describe it that the consciousness would experience green, a ripple of green would go across this membrane, then red, then blue.
Uh-huh.
So what happened?
I can relate to that very much because there you could say that the field of awareness is tactility.
Yeah.
Generally, there's only some variety of tactility, right? Red, green, blue, black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, so what happened is it was red, and then it went to green, and a portion of the red held on and did not give up to the green.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of consciousness looked at the resistance in the red, and one part of it smashed the red. I don't know which color I started with, but whatever it was that was holding out was smashed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an action of judgment. This is the way Cosmo Ware has talked about it. So the principal, the judger that objected to the holdout by the red that should have become completely all green, that was called Rye, R-H-Y-E-E, Rye.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rye smashed the holdout, and the rest of the ripple of the new color, red, objected to that, and they chased Rye down through levels of density. So Rai gets to the end and makes matter as he's going, and then he establishes place here in this world we call it Earth or whatever. But it's the beginning of the principalities or separateness. So the plane of essence was green becoming red, whatever I said, whatever the later development is, they decide to send down a feminine principle to cooperate with Rai, and Rai wanted to then have children and build up his world he had made there, all in separateness. He had left the ocean of singularity in the plane of essence. So the female principle cooperated with the Rai, the male, and the plan was eventually to sucker him into it and then get him back. The female principle would seduce him back to the red zone. So some people I've told this story to, and they say, well, that sounds like a Gnostic story. And I think Edgar Cayce, who McLuhan read, he talked about the matter got created through spirit becoming denser and denser. So it sounds a bit like that. So anyways, Rai, according to cosmic awareness, a cosmic event happened. In January 67, Rai returned to the plane of essence. So no more separateness. So I heard this in the late 60s, and what was left were the cobwebs of Rai. There were still principalities trying to stay in it. So the physical manifestation of this was the crisis in the gold market in 68 in London. There was some kind of crisis, and the people with the big bank accounts, like the Rockefellers and Rothschilds, their planning and their timing was thrown off because of the removal of the ground of separateness when Rai returned awareness. So when I was reading McLuhan around that time, after I'd heard this story, I thought of the membrane as the condition of end of separateness, the end of principalities.
Uh-huh.
So I thought it was interesting that I could see that McLuhan, I could use McLuhan to support or fit in or elaborate what Cosmic Awareness is saying. And then Thiel, talking about it years later with Thiel, he pointed out, he said, note how McLuhan used the word cosmic in 55. I think it's in Five Sovereign Fingers, Tax the Breath, you know, one of those inventories of statements by him. And he rarely used the word cosmic, being careful not to get trapped in the Gnostic image, you know, as a Catholic, I guess. But he used it one time. He said there was a great shift on a cosmic level or a cosmic plane. So I always found it interesting that awareness as a medium was original. They were coming up with a different scenario from the normal cliches that New Age mediums channel. Okay? There was a statement of a change. So when I got McLuhan to occasionally talk mystical or talk on this kind of level, that's where the global membrane came in. It snapped. When Rai returned to essence, it snapped. What's he have here? Snapped round the globe by the electric dilation of our various senses. So anyways, it's just a happy fluke that I came across this obscure little group that had these odd concepts. And they resonated for me with the change that was caused by the global membrane.
Yeah, but when you see, if the membrane has different forms, if it can snap, if it can change its form or have a story, figures coming in and going back to it and all that sort of stuff, then membrane is not some sort of cloud of unknowing. It's a structure, and it's a structure that has changeable forms.
Well, I see it as a structure, but I don't see the changeable forms content.
How can it snap? How can it snap if it doesn't have changeable form?
No, it just does. It's a nebulous world. Yeah, it is what it is.
That's a great explanation.
I'm going towards percept. It is what it is.
Yeah. No, this whole deal really is Gnostic.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, the Gnostics always have to come back to the one. Right? And
to the one as a default?
Yeah, of course. Basically, that's all a Gnostic is interested in.
Yes.
The one.
Yes,
as
yeah.
McLuhan says in his review of Kanner's book on Lewis, he ends his review by saying, let us go back to the one.
Right, and that's why we like Lewis's idea of two-ness. Lewis tried to counter that. With the two-ness,
right.
Which is quoted in Cliched Archetype.
Yeah. So for McLuhan, Lewis is the greatest thinker.
Yeah.
Right. So and you can see that in Lewis's art. Lewis's art is very mechanical, very sort of chaotic in a certain way. If you can imagine straight lines being chaotic.
Well, have you noticed the bubbles, cellular kind of stuff in Toronto in the early 40s? Have you seen those later paintings? They're different. They're blobular.
I don't think I have. I'll have to look that
up.
Yeah,
look them up, the 40s mm-hmm. stuff. He is going through a change during that period anyways because he becomes an internationalist when he gets back to London. He has a different, American cosmic man, the global village.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not thinking the same as he did in the 30s. But the painting reflects something. In a way, he's losing that mechanical hard edge. They're like blurry uh-huh. bubbles.
Right. Well, he's losing his eyesight at that time.
Yeah, that's right. He's going blind, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, he's not. Unless that went on for 10, 20 years, I don't know when it started.
Oh, it must have been a gradual thing over decades, for sure.
Right. But, he really got blind by 50, 51 or so. That's when he couldn't see anymore. But this is 10 years before, 41. But, yeah, maybe mm-hmm. maybe that's what's going on.
I'm not trying to reduce it to that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that that's probably an aspect.
Right. Okay, so we're... We brought up Lewis, so the two-ness. So the digital, the overlay of the Android meme, which allows this digital autonomy where you can get out of the oneness of the 50s global membrane, and maybe you'd include satellite and computer, analog satellite and computer in the 50s and 60s as not digital. So the digital allows you to, then you can start having different global membranes because you could go off and create a conference call with 100 people, right? You still got.
So now you're saying that maybe membrane is plural.
No. With the digital, you get out of the paralytic cosmic membrane. That's only in the TV era.
Oh, so you don't have a membrane anymore.
Well, that's what why I call that period, which is the Crocker quadrant on my chart, 14. There's the one of the global membrane, the TV era, and then the digital allows you to go off into autonomous different spaces, which I call quadrophenia. So the four is now overlaid parallel to the one. That's what I mean by 14. Whereas the global membrane is in the 2-2 in the McLuhan quadrant, which is 47 to 57, 1957. The ratios 2:2, A's to B, C's to D. That is maybe the global membrane, but that 2-2 gets collapsed into 1 when you bring in the digital, and then the 2-2 also becomes the 4. I don't know which way it goes. I mean, tactile-wise, it goes, as McLuhan said, I may have got that backwards, but it goes either way. So 1-4 is a icon for me of the meaning of the new digital autonomy, and people can create different spaces: paranoia, hysteria, panic,
ecstasy,
and schizophrenia. Yeah, and you know what? I don't know if you know Minimax. Do you know Minimax or Brian Taylor? Have you ever interacted with him?
No.
Okay.
I know. I've heard the name Brian Taylor, but I don't know.
So he found a cartoon. And he added this words to it. It has Jesus. I think it's a modern character, but it's taken from Jesus, one of his sermons. And the guy says, it's not fear, people. It's not fear that we have to fear. It is paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and then ecstasy. And I said, that's exactly my point. It's not, you know, we have to fear fear. It's not the case now. We got 5 realms here. You know what I mean? Paranoia, and they're put-ons. People act paranoid. They act schizophrenic. They act hysterical, and they panic, and then they have ecstasy. That is, those are the conditions of autonomy. And I spelled this out in my essay, Up the Orpagandy, in 95. And so that's
those 5 states must correspond to the 5 bodies.
The 5 what?
The 5 bodies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They don't. The bodies don't have to be that state, but I overlaid. Yeah, that's what the chart is. You know, you've got the holopathic environment. Holopathic is my term for the membrane, because remember, the satellites create the effect of the hologram through the word that makes the market. So the news gets quite doing more with less in the 70s and 80s. Before you get the digital cable and the spinning off and all kinds of new sources. But in that period where the satellites have fully blossomed and you've got the percentage marriage, and then people are living inside the global membrane, which is expressed by the word that makes the market at the White House, that keeps shrinking and tightening and becoming more membraned. You could say more oneness. That's the holopathic principle, hologram going through homeopathic shrinkage. And so I had holopathic radio / satellite. The ground is satellite. Holopathic radio is the figure. So you got holopathic radio, and that is paranoia. Holopathic TV is schizophrenia. And then I have different astral bodies from theosophy in each quadrant. Then I have Bob's 5 bodies. So I'm overlaying all the different columns across right. each quadrant. And that's right. where you get your synchrony or synchronic. So
listeners should observe how your mind is a narrative mind. You like to think in terms of stories. You like to think in terms of mythologies, if you will.
Well, I like to give examples. You know, I don't want to just have an abstract word.
But examples of?
Well, stories. Stories are examples. I like to try to make it understandable.
Yeah, but but there's more going on there. You're trying to make things understandable for people that are listening, but you are also working on your own understanding.
Well, you could say my own subjectivity.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you like to listen to bizarre stuff. you always have done that,
yeah.
Right? When you were on the radio and in Toronto.
Yes.
Conspiracy theories or.
I like to listen to people's interesting subjective stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they can be theology like the Armstrongs or.
Yeah.
You don't care what it is.
That's right. It's all fatty communion to me.
yeah. But the way your mind works is that you like to think along.
Yes.
With people.
Yeah.
But then, a little bit like McLuhan, you take it further than they did.
That's right. I start making principles, theories, laws, and conclusions about it.
And charts.
Yeah, that's what people, they used to say I was a great listener because I would go along and listen to their unique story, and then I'd make a meaning out of it that they'd never thought of, you know what I mean? So they'd be flattered that I came up with a big insight from it, but that's my ability to find patterns in any story anybody presents to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's your preferred way of finding patterns and of formulating patterns, I must say.
Yes.
So in my old age, I'm having trouble with my throat here.
Spit up. You can go spit.
Yeah, no, I'm fine now.
Okay.
I'm fine. I don't know. It was a brief... disturbance in the global membrane.
Yes, it was rather schizophrenic.
Yeah.
No, so okay.
That highlights the difference that we always have between your diachronic or chronological way of proceeding and my attempts to find the synchronic laws or structures that are behind all this.
Well, I think that I'm doing that, but... it doesn't come across that way to you. You call it the narrative. I'm certainly aware of the synchronic overlays or the big now and the collage and the assemblage.
But you're always tempted to say, oh, that was 1985 or that was 1957 or 63.
Oh, okay. That's to evoke moods. Content to make people remember the music, the texture of that period. That's painting. I'm massaging the person's brain and evoking different moods. Yeah, so to me, 47 to 57, definite atmosphere, definite mood, right? 57 to 67, completely in media content. I have a good memory of what went on, and most people do when they're listening to music. They remember everything while they're listening, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not too good at talking about it when the music's not happening. they run out of memory, instant memory. So, but I always, my alibi is, of course, the Android meme, the chart is visual because it's a piece of paper. It is fragmented. And that's the bias of it. And I point out the bias. And I say, this is nowhere what the Android meme looks like. But it's a way McLuhan said to Richard, whatever that young guy, Castellanets, he says, people need concepts to get a grip on reality. So McLuhan had to put up with people interpreting, reading, understanding media, and getting concepts out of it. They didn't get the percept level, not right away. Unless they did some in-depth repetition and reread the stuff and started to notice it more. So McLuhan threw out concepts because people took it that way. They had to get a grip on reality. So I'm throwing out a picture of the Android meme. It's a picture for visually biased people.
And so is that the topic that we're on?
Yeah.
Is that,
that's always the topic.
Okay, well, why don't you talk a little bit then about the relationship between membrane and Android meme?
All right, let's see. That's what we're trying to get to here, because I'm going into the meme. So I'm explaining the breakup of tactility on page 77, and I'll just restate. Meanwhile, the abrasive confrontational aspects of tactility surfed over the old discarnate merged/interrupting surfaces. This evoked the dominance of the neoconservative liberal meme or preference in the global membrane of the last 35 years. Not knowing this aspect of McLuhan's tactility led to a discounting of McLuhan's relevance on a theoretical level for educational purposes. People didn't think there was theory in there. So I say, I won't go into the pastoral global village, people know that. So I say, making a long narrative short, most of the 20th century can be understood as the analog media phase of involuntary ESP. McLuhan is here talking about the analog media phase culminating in the global theater. Then I quote McLuhan saying electronics as ESP. Then I said, McLuhan's not wrong, he's just incomplete today. One has to deeply understand McLuhan's ramifications of a cool medium first. First, McLuhan explained the phase of our tools shaping us. We are now well into the second phase, the Android meme phase of our tools aping us, what they used to call artificial intelligence, a horseless buggy kind of nomenclature. Let's see, in the blue part. The point is that the Internet brought out the fact that media aped us because the Android memes started to look like people thanks to the new graphic user interface. They were no longer reading text. They were talking cartoons on your computer. So it's they were talking cartoons on your computer, I think is the way to say it. So it's aping us, no longer shaping. I keep pointing this out, and nobody gets it. Nobody gets the significance of the fact that the Android meme was aping us, different from shaping us. Then I quote the album, We Shape Our...
Before we go too far here, yeah. Let's go back to the black paragraph immediately above that.
Yes.
You say that... what they used to call artificial intelligence, a horseless buggy kind of nomenclature.
Yeah.
I don't understand that in the sense that artificial intelligence is very much a word of the day. And calling it a horseless buggy kind of nomenclature seems like an interesting idea. But it needs to be teased out some.
Yeah.
How do you get that?
First of all, I'll just say the Android meme is not artificial. To call it artificial intelligence, it's pattern recognition and it's a living force.
I'll just interject from time to time,
yeah.
And you can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Yes.
What you seem to be saying there is that artificial intelligence is a horseless buggy kind of nomenclature because we've gone beyond what we used to understand as artificial.
Yes. Yep.
So we have to get rid of artificial or at least complexify it, and we have to do the same thing with intelligence.
Yes.
And unless we complexify those two things and then bring them together in an even more complex way, then we're not going to understand what the Android meme is.
That's right. And you definitely won't get to the tech body.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
So you see, this is what's interesting on the Medium as a Massage album. They say, I think they first say, no, I have the time here. You first hear somebody say, we shape our tools and thereafter our tools ape us. Then later, it's re-said, but it's we shape our tools and thereafter our tools shape us. The shaping is more what people understand about the medium massaging us. But the aping us is the beginning of the creation of the Android meme, which is going to be an organic thing that's left the human. It becomes its own... environment that is, as he says in 68, which is the right time to say it because it's after Raiz, his return to essence in 67. Now, when he talks about the cobwebs of Raiz, that is the schizophrenia, those five things. And that becomes string theory.
But you see how you like to have a year.
Well, though, that's when it happened.
67 and 68.
Because 68 is 67. But it's when he wrote it in 67, and the book comes out in 68. But it's right at that point where he announces that the environments are organic and alive.
Uh-huh.
He did not say that earlier. Maybe some obscure place once, but he says it in the Playboy interview, and he says it in War and Peace in the Gold Village. So there's a new shift. I'm noticing McLuhan shift through the different phases. Remember I told you he gets ill at every new technology. So I'll give a date so you'll know when he got sick. But it's
all right.
It's when it could have been 1922 if the television came in and then. You know, it happened then. He's responding to the environment, and you help people locate it by giving a date of when television came in, and that's when the shift happened. So it's just helping people, visually biased people, get a grip on what's happening here.
Right. But you see, when you talk about a new kind of organic, an old kind of organic is breaking down, or new kind of organic is evolving.
Emerging,
yeah, I mean, to me, what's interesting there is that you're insisting a little bit like the Cambridge English School that words never have meaning alone. They only have meaning in context.
Right.
And the context changes.
Yes.
And the words change along with them. But words are not just things that are in the air or that are on paper. Words are in relation to things. And the things that are changing with the word organic is what we understand about ourselves and what we understand about the world.
Mm. Okay.
That makes sense?
I'm not sure. I don't have a problem with the words, but we're trying to get you to get me. I'm not trying to understand you.
No, exactly.
Right.
So if I say, does that make sense, I'm not talking about in some sort of absolute sense.
Right.
And I'm not talking in terms of my blog or something. I'm trying to say, does it make sense in terms of what you're saying?
Well, okay, say it again. You're talking about different words, and there are shifts.
Yeah, well, I'm saying you were talking about a new kind of organic.
Yes.
And what I hear you saying there is that the old reference of organic, the old both the content, the context of organic, and what organic meant within that context, those things are both dissolving or are imploding. And we have to understand organic in a whole new way.
Yes, because there's a new environment that makes up the organic. Something's been added to it.
Added or replaced?
Infused. An imminence. You know that? Immanence.
Yeah.
Imminence, pervasiveness. You know, the world with satellites around it by 1970 is different from 1920. So a new color, a new music has been added to the electric mix. So that shifts a lot of things. And the implosion and interacting of things becoming information is a way of saying they become alive, because by the late 60s, the environments are ethereal. They're interplaying, and it's uh-huh. Dancing on the same spot. And
right.
And
but you see, what I'm trying to get at, Bob, is that when you talk about something coming alive, that cannot, I think, be understood in terms of what we know or what we used to know about being alive.
Yeah.
Something alive is being cached in a different way here.
Yep.
So if you understand coming alive in the old sense of being alive, then what you think of is Frankenstein on the table with Dr. Frankenstein trying to use lightning to bring him alive. Right? That's the old sense of alive.
Yes.
But, and so there's a new sense of alive being talked about here. And the difficulty is that you have to use words to talk about this stuff. And you have to talk to an audience that has different pictures in their mind, like Dr. Frankenstein. But what's really at stake is sort of the elasticity of the word alive and new shapes are being exposed in that elasticity there.
Right. So it seems to me to say this, the separatenesses, the blurring of what people thought was animate and inanimate. And you
right.
see this in the popular culture. People start taking drugs, different psychedelic drugs, and they think Gaia is alive. They think nature is alive, and they have all this excitement, new insights. And I would say that is conceptualizing the merger of satellite computers and television and radio, which homeopathizes, shrinks, miniaturizes. So I would just go back to the phrase, the walls break down. There's less separateness in the images that people had and were created by literacy. Like there's a tree out there or there's nature. And I can read about the categories of nature in a book. So that creates a separateness. Remember that he does say the printing press creates a split between the head and the heart, and so there's a lot of fragmentation going on. But then it suddenly flips into the implosion of analog electricity, and then the digital even makes it more intense. So I would say the organicness is a misplaced concrete. You start to think objects are disappearing or merging. So people don't know what is wheatgrass anymore. They start thinking, straw. What's that? Starbucks is wheatgrass. The differences between objects and people are melting. So the inner
right.
becomes the outer, and the outer. McLuhan's always has different phrases about this. The mixture of the inner and the outer. The external and the interior, that's being blurred by the media mix, which is affecting language, and then that affects people's concepts and images.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really showing how much the shaping of us, and you get a clue of how we're being shaped by what Broadway plays there are, what kind of music happens, what's happening in sport. You look across the board, and then by 1975, everybody's wearing mustaches and sideburns and all that. It's a colossal preference that happens. Do you know what I mean? Or an acceptance of what was not accepted before, like walking around with your slovenly clothes. Which, you know, I noticed that when I was in L.A. in 93. When we first moved to the States, we were in L.A. for 6 months. So it was a good stretch of time to be there, and because it's such a warm climate, the slovenliness of people was surprising. And so I got to experience it for 6 months, just going to the supermarket. I didn't get that in Toronto. because it's too cold, you know. Weather's a little harder. But you have people in L.A., we were living in Venice, that wore the same sweatshirt and sweatpants. You'd see them every day for 6 months, you know. They didn't change.
Yeah.
And you must have experienced that in California.
Oh, sure. And sometimes in their bathrobe, right?
Yeah.
So, but what date was that you were there? 76?
No, 90. We finally left Toronto in February 93. And we lived in L.A. for 6 months at Jerry Fiocca's. And then we moved to New York City. We were based, the operation, which was the treatment of AIDS, was based in New York on East 65th Street. And, but they wanted us to go, or Carolyn to go to L.A. to deal with the branch office there first. So it was a detour to help the operation in L.A., but we were eventually going to be going to New York. And so we got to New York in August after being getting to California in February. And then we spent 15 years in New York, and now we're almost 15 years here. We're in our 13th, going on our 14th year here. And I did 15 years in Toronto, 15 years in Halifax. It's that's the way it's been going. Four quadrants of 15 years in each place.
And so if you're coming up to 15 in Maui, does that mean that you're on your way to Tibet or something?
We're on our way to the bunker because the world's going to get real bad shape.
Uh-huh.
And the bunker is in a different place. It's not on Maui.
Uh-huh.
We've already got it locked down. You know, I know where we're going.
Uh-huh.
So that's...
How do you...
What?
How are you planning on getting there?
A private plane. We have a very supportive team. We've got a lot of money behind us. I mean, the guy that Ion comes through is a billionaire.
Uh-huh.
So there's no problem for autonomy. You know what I mean? We probably can even bypass the vaccine passport stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been looming, depending on events, for 6 months. And I don't know if I'm suddenly not here, that's where I went. And I would eventually get in touch with you, but I don't know how strict we are about hiding at first. Do you know what I mean? So we wouldn't have any online activity. We'd be off the grid, so to speak. And there'd be different reasons why that's going to happen. So in our interaction, I would eventually, I'm pretty sure, I've been told, we'll eventually be able to resume a little bit after the transition. So if I'm gone, that's what happened. Don't take it personally. I'll be back. I didn't unfriend you. Anyways, back to this. This organic blur, mixing up of boundaries. You know, like great line in 55. It's from Dylan Thomas. Five sovereign fingers tax the breath. That to me, it's, you know, you got tactility, you got your internal organs being affected. There's some kind of pressure happening to you, right? And it's a tactile pressure because it's the extension of the sovereign fingers. You remember that line, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But you see, again, we got 1955.
No, I'm just helping you find it.
Yeah. But let's. Let me ask you
the five sovereign fingers tax the breath, that started with radio, you know, in the 20s, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. Okay, well, it wasn't happening in 1733.
Okay, but let me ask you my question, Bob. A while back, you mentioned that in with the, I think you were talking about 1970, and you were talking about a complete satellite environment. And you were saying that this was completely different from the 1920s, you said.
Yes.
Now, the thing is, of course, in one sense, it's completely different from the 1920s. But in another sense, everything that came to be in 1970 was already there in the 1920s.
And in the 1880s in the telegraph environment.
Correct. Well, or in 10 BC, right? I mean, the elements were already there. The working of the elements together were already there. So what is it that
They didn't have the radio environment in 10 BC.
No, they didn't have the radio environment, but they had the chemical materials and the physical laws that would allow the radio to become a reality in around 1900, right? So the in one sense, everything is the same.
You're talking about the effects, and the radio is the cause. Or you're talking about causes, and the effects haven't arrived.
Well, what I'm looking for is simply a description from your point of view about what it is that changes between, let's say, 1920 and 1970, a 50-year period. What is it that changes when the background, the physical and chemical background is the same, but the historical foreground or figure is completely different? And what is it that's changed? What is it that's allowed that change?
Well, television, you add the tactile eye. It's not radio. You can see. It's more inclusive of the other senses than radio.
No, of course, from between 1920 and 1970, there's all sorts of inventions.
Yeah.
And inventions allow the idea of television, which was very much around in 1920, they allow the actuality of television by the 1940s.
Yeah, and the Philo Farnsworth creates electric television in the States in 37.
Okay.
But it's not an environment yet. It's just in his lab. It's one little device. It's not an environment.
Okay, but you see, the physical and chemical background is the same.
What is the physical and chemical? Are you talking about oxygen, nitrogen?
Yeah.
Nature.
The physical nature and its potential is the same. But what's different is that there's inventions and the development of environments, as you would say. And what I'm looking for, Bob, is your description of what kind of changes allow the great difference between 1920 and 1970. Is it the exercise of mind? Is it something more than that? Is it something less than that?
It's the frequency of the new inventions. The nitrogen, oxygen are, that's book categories. There may be frequencies beneath how we visualize the chemistry. Maybe acoustic frequencies, you know, some of the mystics go into you've seen the Saito, those videos of sounds altering the salt in the water?
The
particulate?
No, I haven't. But
yeah, what are those called? Cytograms
imagine.
Or something? Cryonics or... you show, you know, you take you put some music on a solution and the thing starts shifting around due to the non-visual acoustic effects.
Uh-huh. Dancing bubbles.
Yeah, in a way. So to talk about nitrogen and oxygen, that's effect of literacy. Those aren't necessarily the elements in the electric age.
Well, I quite agree. That's what my blog is all about, exactly that. But the What I don't understand from your point of view is what the factors are that bring about these changes.
The media look different. You know, a house with television in it in 59 is very different from a house with radio in it in 39.
Yeah, but okay, so you've got those two snapshots.
Yeah.
Right? Well, okay, what goes from one snapshot to the later one? What is it that links them and that that brings about, what is it that makes them both snapshots but also makes them very different as snapshots?
Because they, as objects, they're different. They look different. They involve the senses differently.
But what brings that about?
The environment, the new invention itself. Look at the cell phone.
But what brings the new invention about?
Well, McLuhan liked to say that the radio yearned to be seen. And then suddenly you could see radio with television.
Okay. So there we're getting to what I was trying to talk about with the changes in organic and the changes in life. What you seem to be saying there is that the understanding of the inventor in the Gutenberg galaxy is sort of the isolated mind having some great idea or something like this. That gets transformed in a digital environment, and it's no longer the individual inventor that brings about new things. It's instead the environments themselves are alive in a certain way.
Yeah.
And they have their own genetics.
Their own evolution. Their own genetics, yep. And that's what happened in 53, which, you know, it's not 1953, but other calendars, but we call it 53. And that's when Crick and Watson discovered the gene and McLuhan discovered the meme.
And why do you say that 53 was when McLuhan discovered the meme?
That's when he figures out finning his wake, and he writes those articles in 53, and they get the Ford grant. They spelled it out enough that Ford people said, yeah, these guys are on to something, so we'll give them a grant. He does in 53. He talks about the art forms in finning's wake. He's doing finning's wake with Don in 50, 51, 52, but he figures out, gets it really crystal, what is going on in the wake. And he says something that no other people thought of, and maybe not till recently did anybody catch up to McLuhan, that there's different media environments in Finnegan's wake. It's not just a book. It's, as he used to say, you know, it's a radio program. So he started to see environments in there and didn't get lost in the multiple semantic meanings of the collage of 60 languages on each page. He didn't stay in the Gutenberg level of languages. He started to see, no, there's movie environments showing here. There's the tactile spots of television happening here. That's a whole different way to look at the book. He's actually seeing synchronically. He's seeing all kinds of stuff that is not in the book. But he says it's in the book. It's evoked by the book. All future technologies are in Finnegan's wake. And the clatter of email and texting that people go through the last 15 years, that's a big chunk of Finnegan's wake. That's how it's presented. You know, endless bickering, responding. You know, a lot of paragraphs with the line in front of it, meaning it's being said. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm trying to think along with you here. What I hear you saying is that McLuhan in 1953 is dropping the idea of the individual being kind of an atomic person, and instead people engage in different ways with collective identities and roles and masks.
And that's in Collegiate Archetype. I think it's around page 161 or so, where he talks about Ulysses is about the individual ego, and then the Phineas Wake is corporate interfacing, not private self.
Right. And you're saying that he starts to put that idea together in 53 or
52, and then he knows it in 52, and he writes it out in 53. And he does several essays. He figures out how to describe Lewis as different from Joyce. And these are the people that that he's meditating on. He's very involved with Pound. Pound is helping him see this. So he makes great statements about Pound in that period, the Pound essay, the Lewis essay, and the two Joyce essays. They're about 53. They might be 54, 52, but they're in the interior landscape. That is a that's when he drops being a critic. He then does the critic thing in Renaissance for 10 more years, but he's absorbing whatever he's reviewing into his media model. He's not doing traditional criticism and writing about what the story is in the book that he's reviewing. He's just repeating his party line in every review. And John Pick let him do that. Probably couldn't have done it anywhere else. See what I'm saying? He takes every review as an excuse to say his perceptual pattern that he started in 53.
What you're calling his party line is actually a kind of probing, right? He doesn't really know himself what he's thinking towards. He needs to find that out, and he needs to find it out like a blind person in a room that they've never been in before. And so he's reading these books, and he's
talking to the seminar. He needs to bounce off people, see how they react to it.
Absolutely. So in reading and in talking and in maybe his dreaming, what's going on is he's feeling his way around a whole new environment.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know what it is. He doesn't know how to talk about it. All he knows is...
Well, he knows how to talk about it a little bit. And he's broken into the silent sea. Then he's got to figure out, how are the people going to react to this? At what level does he present his knowing? You know, how much does he have to dumb it down?
Mm-hmm.
And the satellite, he probably didn't see the satellite, didn't foresee what it was going to be till Sputnik showed up. Then he thinks about it for 2 years. Then he starts talking.
He had a good idea of the satellite already in the early 50s. I've got a text. I think I put it in the blog already, but if not, I'll find it and send it to you.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
He describes a satellite environment before Sputnik, for sure.
Well, that's pretty neat. But overall, in general, he watches the effects from 57 to 60, and he has a couple of essays in 60, 61. He talks about television becoming archetypal, and he's really speeding it up. And he's talking about the effect of the satellite and what will happen when the satellite becomes art form. He's on a bigger scale, it seems, in 62. And he's starting to think of managing global environments with that center he builds and designs in 64, where he's going to be measuring sensory thresholds. He's moved completely into another plateau.
I agree, but he's partly been misled there. He's misled by colleagues. He's been misled by his own ill health, by his worry that he may not be around for a while, and so he's grasping at straws that may be bad straws. There's a lot going on there.
But well, yeah, he is doing it. You know, he is trying to figure out. He's on a level no one else is.
Well, that may be. That may be. But I don't. I disagree with your description in one way, and that is that I think he was more at sea in the bad sense than being at sea in the good sense. So you say, oh, he got into the Sargasso Sea, and now he can sort of look down on people and look at their reactions, whereas I think he had a vague idea of making breakthroughs, but he didn't have a good grasp on them. He didn't really understand them or himself, and so he continually had to wrestle with these vague ideas, trying to make them precise, back out of cul-de-sacs and try another avenue.
Right. Now, that's, people didn't see that because he was presenting his 50 stuff in Understanding Media, and that looked pretty cool, detached, and had a poise. But it was, he had moved, he was already working out cliched archetype with Watson. So that's where the real ground was. And, yeah, people didn't see that. And Watson, because Watson saw that, he almost didn't respect McLuhan enough. He saw more of what you're talking about, maybe, because he was trying to compose the book with Sheila and him and Marshall, and they were corresponding a whole new language. The turnover of cliched archetype is the holeopathic process. The interplay of all the media at that point, satellite TV, radio, cars, bulldozers, computers, was intermingling in the stew more and more intensely, holeopathically. And he was trying to figure out that. But he could just talk about visual space and acoustic space, the 50s talk. That was what you were hearing in his speeches in the 60s. It was old stuff. Okay?
Yeah.
And he was hiding. If he was going through a turmoil, like you're saying, he hid that.
Well, I think he definitely was going through turmoil in the 60s, but that was a different turmoil from the 50s.
Yes.
Right?
The 50s presented the 40s. The 40s present the 30s. You know, he was always 10 years behind. And the public was 10 years behind what he was. What they saw him doing, he had done before.
Right.
10 years before.
But done before, I mean, it's like a person eating. It's different to stick it in your mouth. It's a different thing to digest it in your stomach. So he may have stuck, let's say, 1930s stuff into his mouth in the 1940s, but it took him all of the 1940s to digest it.
Yes, so he was digesting what he ate in the 30s and distributing it in the 40s to others.
Correct.
Well, he was digesting. He distracted them with what they were enjoying eating. Later, they'd get the digestive problems too.
Yeah, although personally, I don't think that people are digesting even the 1940s.
Right.
At this point, let alone the 1950s.
Yeah, most people spit it out.
No, for sure.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so what's, we're sort of coming to the end here, but we're actually in a certain way by going through detours and different narratives and stuff, we've come back to page 77 and page 78.
Yes.
Because we've mostly below the surface, we've been talking about tactility and memes, which is what I think you're about to get into in your book.
Yeah, let me end with this. So you go to 79, and get to the below the aping blue paragraph, and look at what I say. The issue is not orality and its spin-offs. It's tactility squared, which has flummoxed all cultures and has them scrambling for new or old identities. The millennials can be understood under this carapace. McLuhan, in Understanding Media, talks about how the desire for more money is a tactile expression. The excessive desire to make money by any means necessary in all our Gutenbergian and Marconian institutions since the 70s period of stagflation is a little-noted example of the Baroque spiral of tactility squared. Emphasizing shareholder values to the exclusion of hardware development is not an extension of visual space, but the endless evolving process of expanding slash exploring the resident interval, popularly known as Wall Street. So there's a mouthful. Then I say, yeah. So far, McLuhan scholars have placed too much emphasis on the role of the trivium in the media poetics of McLuhan. The quadrivium is far more important as a creative ground for McLuhan's post-mechanical bride output. So yes, he was doing the processing the quadrivium in the 60s, maybe even the 50s, and presenting the trivium as the old figure for easy consumption. So what do I say next? It's shaped like this. Make this interesting chart. 1940s, the trivium plus advertising comics. 1950s, the quadrivium plus telephone, motor car, movie, radio, television. And then I have the quadrivium parts. Astronomy, see McLuhan's three Copernican revolutions in letters. Geometry, see McLuhan's Euclidean geometry versus non-Euclidean in Understanding Media. Arithmetic, see McLuhan's Nielsen ratings versus Big Brother's GNP in Take Today. Music, see McLuhan's musical on Russians and Elvis. That's in the 50s. 1960s, the quadrivium. You wanted to say
before
something?
I just want to ask this question. We came back from the tech body to looking at the Android meme and to the development of memes and of tactility.
Yes,
and so now you are suddenly jumping into McLuhan again.
Yeah.
Right? Earlier you had talked about the medium and the message and stuff like this, and then we got away from McLuhan, and now you're going back into McLuhan. So what's the point of going back into McLuhan? Is McLuhan here a way of describing or re-describing what you've just been talking about with memes and tactility, or is it a transition to something beyond that?
Well, I know people now, not so much in the 60s, they know the PhD. So I'm bringing in thoughts that people will have. They'll get lost in handling the trivium and not so much the quadrivium, but there's a lot of thinking about his PhD. So they're dragged back to there. So I want to include that exploration, that part of McLuhan's backlog, to show that I'm including that. And I think I'm trying to get somewheres here.
But my question is, why are you going to McLuhan?
Because other people would bring it up. They go, well, what about his PhD? What about the trivium, the quadrivium? A lot of people make a lot out of that. So I'm trying to complexify the trivium and the quadrivium to get to the Android meme phase. So I have the trivium plus in the 40s. Then I have the quadrivium plus in the 50s. Then I have the 60s is the quadrivium plus later development, satellite, cyborg, mixed corporate media, the global theater. Then I've got the tetrad in the 70s plus instant replay. And he's saying the instant replay is the biggest metaphysical rupture for humans ever. Then the laser beam and the hologram.
That's why I speak about synchronicity all the time.
Right. So I'm bringing in the stuff that he actually talked about in the 70s, like the five parts of rhetoric. He mentioned that a little more than in the 60s and 50s. And then you have Hendiadi. So I'm looking at fragments from Cliched Archetype, Take Today, papers he was writing, and then the Tetrad. So I want to show I'm trying to include the vast array of things he was working. Just to name it means I'm including it. Look at this Hendiades of the Quadrivium via Marshall McLuhan, a sum of lifeless artifacts. That's from an article. Planet of the Dead, to go outside to be alone. So I'm bringing in all the ideas of his 70s output. And let's see.
You understand my question about why you're doing this? Is it because McLuhan can
I'm integrating. I'm integrating all of McLuhan. People, I don't know, three people in the world, they've read enough to notice, okay, he's talking about the Quadrivium and five parts of rhetoric, the four levels of exegesis in the 70s. Is that a new thing? Why did he bring it up so late? And it's kind of trivial. It's old Gutenberg stuff. So I'm trying to show everything that he added from the 40s to get to a comprehensive including that I'm showing that I'm not leaving anything out about all the stuff McLuhan talked about. So, it's pretty comprehensive. I've got here trivial, last word, cliche, dialectical, art form, grammatical. These are interesting patterns in themselves, how I'm using his ammunition. So get through using all that, and I'm going down to page, 82, and I've got here Jean Baudrillard was on the appropriate angle. So we're dealing with different angles in the sphere. When he said that he regarded McLuhan as a musician. So I want to bring that up. I think it's a great idea. It's a way to get us out of the literate categories of media study that he presented in Gutenberg and Understanding Media. If McLuhan's a musician and he's working with the Quadrivium, that opens up scenarios that people hadn't thought of in relation to McLuhan. So I'm bringing in the synesthete and the co-anesthete. So here I am saying the only musical paramedia ecologist who was keeping up with McLuhan was Frank Zappa. Who are that? People, 99.9%, what are you talking about? Zappa's fucking rocker. You know what I mean? But I'm trying to show McLuhan after 62 is dealing with post-Gutenberg environments way more. He's not a writer even anymore. And that's what Peter Montgomery noticed. He said, as a student hanging out with McLuhan, he said, something shifted around 62. He just wasn't interested in his literary criticism anymore. That's because he was managing whole environments. So you got to look at him as a musician or as a guy doing chemistry in the lab with genes. Got to get him into the Frankenstein level because that's what he sounded like when he did that proposal in 64 for a center measuring population sensory thresholds. People, I brought that up occasionally with a different academic. They go, that's fascism. That was their immediate reaction. Why would he be allowed to do that? Well, if you understood the disruption that was happening with each new environment in the 1670s, you might tolerate someone manage them, just like McLuhan would say, you manage the economy. But the economy was inside a larger economy of information whirlpools. So he's offering a means to show what you're being massaged with, and your issues about private identity and all those literate things, and you're trying to adapt a little bit to some communal ideas, are so puny compared to the massive environments we're in and we're being put in by the 70s. So you got to start looking at McLuhan as the media management. And Ted Carpenter told me he didn't like that. He says, no, I couldn't take that global thermostat, McLuhan. I went back to the aesthetics. That's what I was interested in. And actually, he dropped out completely and did anthropology. He looked up that guy and made a big bunch of volumes around him. He fell back into the specialism of anthropology, and he couldn't take the later McLuhan. I still don't find people can take it. They don't want to look at the reality. They think that's a put-on, what he's saying in Playboy.
Mm-hmm. You see, I am very interested in these ideas, right? My blog tries to come to terms with all this stuff in McLuhan and has been doing so for 10 years.
Yeah.
But
and you're doing a good job of it.
Well, thank you. But what I don't understand is why you want to get into McLuhan at this point in your pamphlet.
Because I want to include, I want to show that I'm aware of all the other aspects of McLuhan that haven't been mentioned yet.
Yeah, yeah, but for, to what end? Why is that?
I think it helps to get to the rupture and get into the Android meme and how he anticipates the meme with his verbal module. So everything has to be said. I've got to include everything about McLuhan, all the things he was doing to show, and for most people, they can't even take it. They don't know that much about McLuhan. They didn't know it covers all that stuff. So I'm trying to stretch their concepts about McLuhan to get them ready for this dramatic anticipation of the meme and then the tech body.
Okay, so that I guess what you may be saying is that if we're going to understand a meme, and then if we're going to understand the Android meme,
yeah,
then we have to understand the few people that were talking about this stuff, or at least intuiting this stuff. And there, the people are McLuhan or Zappa or Joyce.
And Barry Nevitt. I'd include Barry Nevitt. He was the only one who could take this talk of the colleagues around McLuhan.
I'm surprised at that. To me, Nevitt's a little bit mechanical in
yes.
his thought.
Yeah, but that may be because he's got to use words with you, and that's what you're seeing. But if you read his books carefully, I think he does a pretty good job of not being mechanical.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to the surface reader of McLuhan, of Barry, they say, oh, he's just repeating McLuhan. No, man, in his books, he talks issues and disciplines and scientific developments that McLuhan didn't know about.
Right.
So he's...
To give Barry his due, he's also trying to think through stuff that he doesn't really understand perfectly, right?
Well,
and that's not to say that I do.
Right.
I'm trying to say that when people are genuinely thinking and when they're generally genuinely being interesting, then it's because they're engaged with stuff that they don't have a complete handle on.
Yep.
Handles aren't interesting.
Right. So they're seeing events in the media like streaking in 1974 and Barry McLuhan get patterned. They get meaning from that. They say, yeah, that's what we're talking about. And then they make a statement about it. They kept observing what was going on and talking about it. Ted Carpenter wasn't doing that. Harley Parker wasn't. Harley Parker was drunk. Logan and de Kerckhoff are starting to do a few, you know, replay of Gutenberg issues and trying to do a book, but they're not dealing with the present. Now, I say I was. I was in there in the radio, and I was listening to people, what they had to say, and then try to apply McLuhan's formula to their situation, to prompt them to look at McLuhan. I put myself right out there doing McLuhan every week.
Yeah.
Eric was teaching executives how to fucking spell. you know about that, eh? He and a guy named Davis,
I know they had
their company.
Their little business, yeah.
Yeah, for executives. Eric didn't. He had to have a job. He had to raise his family. He couldn't be, you know, fooling around on CKLN like I did. I had the time and freedom to do it. And people go back and listen to that stuff, and they go, wow, you were so far ahead, everybody. Now, I don't know if I'd say that, but that's the effect it has on people. It's so new to them, what I'm saying way back then. It works. It's a good repository of McLuhan in action.
But not just McLuhan, right? You were
right.
doing Mae Russell and all these kinds of people, and Herbert Armstrong.
I was overlaying them. They were symbolically seeing the same thing, but presenting the trivium. Mae Russell was dialectics. No, she was arithmetic. Dr. Beter was astronomy. Finnings-Wake was geometry. Zappa was music. Herbert W. Armstrong, fundamentalist preacher, was grammar. LaRouche was dialectics, and McLuhan was rhetoric. And I have a memo to Prince Charles. It's laid out in one of my in one of the pamphlets on Bosmian ecology. So I would say, okay, I'm giving opinions, but actually it's organized around a formula that has 10 factors, 7 plus I brought in the occult with the mediumship, and that was my formula to interact with the public. I was telling someone the other day that people need to learn McLuhan to be part of the Esperanto. You're not giving your opinions. You're finding a language that every culture could use. They can learn the basics from a Barry Nevis books or McLuhan, and they can talk McLuhan as a as almost like a cult jargon. It wouldn't have to be a cult, and we'd have a global language. Because we can't use left, right, or any of the categories anymore, private, public. None of them work. So you've got to use the kindergarten language that McLuhan created, you know, a basic vocabulary that every culture could talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree completely with that. It's just that the language that is used is not some sort of final language.
No.
The language only works because it itself is in question.
Right.
Right? So if you think about chemistry, for example, the elements that were first isolated, like oxygen, in the 1780s, those elements are to this day continually being specified and respecified.
Right.
So the language that McLuhan was putting forward was a sort of a first attempt to find a way to talk transculturally.
Yes.
Chronologically. And so those ideas need to be tested against the facts of the world, but they also need to be specified in themselves continually.
And, yeah, here's a neat response. He said that Orpheus tuned the world, and now we're back. And he talked about, in some interview, I have it there somewhere, about he's talking to an executive in the car industry, and he talks about now anybody or someone who knows what McLuhan knows can be the new Orpheus. Now what we have fallen Orpheuses. People don't know what they're doing, but they get put into the Orpheus position. Bill Gates, now it's Larry Fink in Wall Street. They're new Orpheuses who are lousy at it and don't understand what the responsibilities are. So you can retrieve the original conscious Orpheus, McLuhan, and understand why he said, give it to me, I'll orchestrate the planet, because it's already being done by the assholes. You know, the George Soros and those guys. And they're, you can do it. That's why it's happening. And that's why the population thinks there's conspiracies happening everywhere, because it's actually able to be done. The Orpheus factor is there. But you can't put it in 19th century conspiracy terms. You know, you just end up being anti-Semitic or something. It's silly. You've got to McLuhan was presenting how to be a new kind of Freemason.
Correct. Yeah, this is all correct.
Good. Yeah. You won't hear it from anybody else. You're the only one who could get it, what I'm talking about.
We need to specify it so that more people understand it and they can apply it.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, something like this is already being applied,
yes,
but disastrously.
Yeah.
So the idea needs to be transformed into something that's both more transparent and more applicable, more useful.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm always been doing it on the radio. I'm always adapting it or seeing how to do it.
Yeah.
I've got different generations. I got many generations I've done this to.
Well.
It's a tiny operation, but it can be a chaotic butterfly, right? It can be.
Yeah.
It can affect. We don't know how much we are interacting with each other and influencing each other.
That's right. That's right. And it's not as if there's an alternative.
Yeah, there's.
Right?
I mean, it's not as if there is. There is no alternative.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I mean, that we got to do what we got to do.
Right, and I've kept faithful at doing it. Now I've got this ion factor, which is a whole other thing, and I'm glad to have something different to bounce off of. And the change in matter is what our products are about. Our products work tremendously because of these extra dimensions that are put in there, and that's a whole other story. But I would say it was very fortunate to be living with someone who was a good doctor and could respond to the changes and have solutions through the last 40 years for when chronic fatigue came in, when environmental allergies came in. Then there was chronic fatigue and then immune deficiency. She handled all of them through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then we have this new, really a weird situation, and she's got solutions for that. She's always had solutions. So I've watched her respond to the environments that are happening and the changes in body percept that led to a lot of stress on people. I could see that's another part of the chart. I've got environmental allergies, chronic fatigue. I've got the medical problems that surface starting in the late 70s in response to each homeopathic environment. So I had her experience to, she was the thing in my lab I could observe. And I was talking about this the other day on the show. In a way, Carolyn was in the position of dealing with the effects immediately in her patient population, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I can buy that.
Yeah.
I can buy that. That's McLuhan tried to use his seminars in a similar
yes.
way.
He was doing that all the time. He needed students. He needed to have people come in and tell him what the effects are on the 15-year-old. Like he would say, I learned from my students. That's what he was doing. He was studying everybody as symptoms.
Yeah. All right. So that's probably a very good way to end.
Yep.
So what we'll do next time is we will come back to start with your new consideration of McLuhan at this point in the book.
Yeah, page 80.
And at least from my perspective, what we have to understand is him not offering answers or fixed categories, but attempting probes.
Yep. Yeah, and the new Orpheus.
Yeah.
In that sense, he was always, somebody said, all criticism is autobiographical. All of McLuhan's media calls was autobiographical. It was about what
yep,
he
I
was.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree with that. Yeah.
Okay, we'll end with that point. We'll start around page 80 next time.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, great.
Will
Thanks
do.
A lot.
Thank you. Ciao, ciao.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Look forward. Bye-bye.
Bye.